Welcome to The Crucible, where the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy gives you a front row seat to conversations with specialists in the minerals and metals sector. SIAM has well over 100 years' experience in and commitment to protecting the professional standards of our industry. Join us now as we discuss the key issues and global initiatives to give you the relevant information needed to make informed decisions, to influence policy that directly affects our sector, and to help our industry grow in an uncertain future.
Hi, and welcome to the SIAM podcast, The Crucible. I'm Buhle Xakalashe, and I'm the head of new technology in the pyrometallurgy division at MINTEC, the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy. In collaboration with the SIAM Western Cape branch, will be hosting the Hydrometallurgy Conference 2024, themed Hydrometallurgy for the Future. We have Professor Johan Petersen in studio, and we'll be talking everything hydrometallurgy today. I welcome Prof. Petersen, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, Buhle. Good to be here.
Many thanks, Prof. As a point of departure, could you kindly say a few words about your background?
Okay, so I'm a professor in chemical engineering at the University of Cape Town with a research focus on hydrometallurgy. Did my undergraduate studies at WITS, and then I came for my PhD to UCT, and had a short stint as a postdoc at the University of British Columbia in Canada, and then since 2003 I'm back here in Cape Town initially as a researcher and then as a full-time academic.
Okay, many thanks, Prof, for that impressive CV. So I think we'll start over with questions that will touch on education, particularly then, of course, relating to hydrometallurgy. The first one is, how has your hydrometallurgy training changed from your days as a student until now?
That's quite an interesting question to ask, because I'm a chemical engineer. Hydrometallurgy is not a mainstream discipline in that subject, although hydrometallurgy, in my opinion, is actually more chemical engineering than its fundamental metallurgy. I was privileged enough during my education at WITS to have been lectured by greats like Frank Cranwell, and so that actually sparked my interest specifically in the hydrometallurgical processing, which in my view is really aligned well with my interests in chemical engineering in general. But when I came then to UCT, there wasn't really much in terms of hydrometallurgy at that time. And I really grew that field while I was there through integration in some metallurgy courses. But it is not a mainstream focus in chemical engineering. It's an elective course. And the real training only happens at the level of postgraduate students. And I believe it's not the same in departments where there is a strong metallurgy focus, where there are full year courses on hydrometallurgy, which I think is sensible, because there are quite some fundamental differences between your standard chemical engineering and hydrometallurgy. And so it's a little bit of a mixed bag. And looking at it sort of in a more international context, it's quite interesting to see that I have seen it particularly at the University of British Columbia in Canada, which some might even argue is sort of like a hotbed of hydrometallurgy. But it's even there in the metallurgical canon, just one single course, and the real training happens at the postgraduate level. So changes, I can't quite say whether it's really changed that dramatically over the lifespan of my career, but it has, in my view, always a little bit of a niche existence, but somewhere between chemical engineering and metallurgy, and there's also a strong dimension of chemistry. And so I think it's quite important, and I'll guess we'll cover more of this as we go along in our conversation. It's quite important to nurture the discipline that sort of sits between other more dominant disciplines in academia. A lot of training also is taking place once people have industry placements. So there's quite a few industrial, you know, graduate programs that I've witnessed or taught into for bringing the practice closer together with the theory, which I think is quite essential. So to teach hydrometallurgy just sort of out of the blue in a university environment is probably less effective than training when people actually see it happening in real processes. So that I have certainly seen evolve here in South Africa. A lot of more of these graduate training programs or additional training course programs, CPD type programs that cover hydrometallurgy for people who work in the field. And I think that's quite a good development to see.
Thanks for that comprehensive answer, Prof. So just as a background, I also did a chemical engineering at bachelor's level. I only knew about hydrometallurgy when I was well into my bachelor's in chemical engineering. So my follow-up question then, how are you attracting talent into this field of hydrometallurgy?
It's actually a good question. That's not that easy to answer. I think it is nurturing the interest of students and sparking them. And I have found that, for example, when I did my undergrad myself, I did the course the elective course in hydrometallurgy that was lectured by Grantwell. And then that actually got me interested in the field, because before then I didn't even know existed. And then I sort of pursued it in my postgrad studies. And that's what I see with a lot of my students now as well. It's people who maybe picked up an interest in it in their undergrad courses, or they hear about it and then it really sparks their interest to develop it further. But it's also a good thing, because in terms of attracting talent, I deal mostly with people who are genuinely interested in the subject. Which at the undergrad level, because you hear a bit of this and hear a bit of that, you might not be as focused if you're coming into a chemical engineering postgraduate study. But with hydrometallurgy, I feel the students that I take on generally are very interested. Also, what's important to note is that a lot of my postgraduate students have come from the field of chemistry. And so that is because for them, a lot of this aqueous chemistry stuff that is completely second nature, they're very familiar with it. And it's easier to pick up sort of the process context for them than it is sometimes for the engineers to pick up the chemistry. So that's also an observation I've made. But I think the talent is there. It's very international. I also have quite a few students that come from other countries who are specifically interested in hydrometallurgy. And for me, it's relatively easy because I have a good reputation internationally. I guess for some more junior academics, it's a little hard to achieve the same, because, you know, they're just not as well known internationally. When I was at the University of British Columbia, that, as I mentioned earlier, it was sort of considered a hotbed of hydrometallurgy. So people applied there specifically because they were interested in the field.
Thanks, Prof. So the next one, again, is a follow-up from what you have mentioned. You talked a bit into collaborations between academic institutions. So the next one is the strong academia industry collaborations in hydrometallurgy locally. And is the picture different when compared to other regions or countries such as Europe? You have now mentioned Canada, maybe in China, when it comes to collaborations.
Okay, so I've got connections all over the globe, which I'm quite proud of. The University of British Columbia came because I did my postdoc there. I'm German, so I've quite a few connections back into Germany. I mean, Buchler, that's how we met, back in Aachen. And it's, So I'm collaborating there. I have some good connection into Central South University in Changsha in China. I've been there many times as a visitor. And so they have quite a strong, they have a whole department that dedicated to hydrometallurgy, which is that quite different to what we have here. I've got good links into Australia, particularly at the hotbed of hydrometallurgy, Murdoch University in Perth, and also some connections in South America. So I've got quite a good perspective of how this is happening in different places. But and it's interesting where sort of metallurgy or particularly hydrometallurgy fits in different curricula. So in Canada, North America, it's mostly around, well, it's somewhere between materials engineering. That's what it actually department in UBC was materials engineering, or more associated with mining. South America, all the metallurgical extraction is in mining department. So it's a little bit, has a more of a sort of niche existence, but it may also have its good sides because the students that study there have more of an insight into aspects of geology, mineralogy, and so forth, which I think are quite critically important to know in hydrometallurgy. Europe is very interesting because I really feel like what I've seen is hydrometallurgy is very small. Again, it's part of the mostly of metallurgical departments, but because of the long standing tradition of pyrometallurgical processes, hydrometallurgy doesn't have, I have not really found anywhere in Europe that is a hotbed of hydrometallurgical processing, certainly not in the universities. It might be a little bit better in some research companies or research organizations, but even there, it's not that great. In Australia, I get the impression it's a strong trend, also something that I've heard of in North America, where all of the departments that teach metallurgical engineering are in serious decline. They're not even managing to find enough students anymore. Programs getting cancelled. So it's very much becoming a niche discipline in academia. Although, on the other hand, in terms of sort of industrial development, it is very strong in hydrometallurgy, but it's more than in the private sector. And as I said, in China itself, that's where I've seen it. There's own self-standing disciplines and which, you know, have good, strong collaborations with industry. So that is a very healthy setup over there.
Okay. Many thanks, Prof. That's quite interesting. You gave a very nice global picture on this. Much appreciated. Cool. You know, so what now is of interest? Of course, then you train these hydrometallurgists and now they become young professionals or emerging researchers or industry players. So do we keep them in South Africa? So could you talk to hydrometallurgy skills in South Africa in view of brain drain?
That's an interesting one. I think that's sort of like an ever-changing picture. Certainly sort of like 20 years ago, a lot of talent was lost specifically to Australia. And it's still today when I go to Australia and interact with colleagues in the field, a lot of them are South Africans or of South African origin. So that brain drain certainly happened back then. My sort of more recent graduates, when they were from South Africa, they have found work in South Africa, both in academia and in industry. So I'm not sure that is still an acute problem. But I think there is, and that's partially, I think, facilitated through industry making it more easy for people, particularly with advanced degrees, because as I said, most of them are postgraduate, to actually enter into the field and get additional training programs, exposed to additional training programs in the companies specifically focused on hydrometallurgy. The other thing is, though, a little bit that, and I guess we'll discuss this a bit more later, that did hydrometallurgy, particularly in South Africa, competes a lot with minerals processing. So for if you just take the platinum industry, you have dozens of concentrators with milling, flotation, and so on, and you have a small handful of PGM refineries where the hydrometallurgy is taking place. So the demand for people with hydrometallurgy skills, it's a relatively small, again, it's a niche discipline, whereas the classic minerals processing has a much higher demand for people with that kind of training, but it's not hydrometallurgy. I want to draw a very clear distinction there.
Okay, that's quite interesting, Prof. The last one, maybe that's education-oriented. Is hydrometallurgy research well-funded, and where is funding mainly sourced from for such research?
I don't want to say no, but I also don't want to say yes. So I have over my career managed to always attract funding from both industry and national funding agencies. So I'm really not one to complain, but it is not exactly easy money. So you have to go around and really build connections with industry. And particularly in terms of research, industry generally is short term. They want some quick tests. They want some results, yesterday. And so research contracts are often just 3 months, 6 months or so, and mostly revolving around testing an established process, which doesn't lend itself to a postgraduate project. And if the timing isn't right, not even to an undergraduate project. So, and as universities, we are not necessarily in the field of test work. That's really more for the likes of Mintec or SGS or organizations like that. But then again, and because it doesn't really lend itself to postgraduate training in that sense. It's more than sort of more on the artisanal level, where you actually say you take people from the University of Technology and give them practical skills. So I don't want to dismiss it as a educational opportunity, but for the more fundamental theoretical training, we would normally need to look at least 1 year, if not 2 year projects. And so those are not as easy to come by, particularly from industry. National funders, yes, there are opportunities, but I rely a lot also on my international collaboration, particularly European Union funding is relatively easy to come by, and we here in South Africa have a sort of privileged status to tap into a lot of these funding calls together with European organizations. And then generally, because of exchange rate, that is generally quite favorable in terms of funding. But yeah, it's not easy, particularly if you're a newcomer, young. I think some of my younger colleagues are in South Africa, other institutions are struggling to, and then obviously if you struggle to get funding, you also struggle to build the expertise that you need. And I think there are various incentives given by the government to industry to develop these kind of collaborations, but yeah, I'm not quite sure. I don't really have the insight how well that's working, and it still is ultimately boils down a lot in who you know in industry, that is also sets up a different problem, is because industry people move through ranks, they switch companies relatively frequently. And so once you build up a good relationship with someone who's in charge of R&D in a given company, then move on. And then the new person won't necessarily, you have to start from scratch again, building the connection.
Thanks, Prof. I mean, this emphasizes the importance of building a strong network and also there are collaborations both locally and globally. Thanks for painting that picture. So the next one now is talking to hydrometallurgists and industry, and it's not so focused more on the academic side of things. So I'll just set a scene for my next question. Energy and water are two critical inputs in the hydrometallurgical process flow sheets, and their increasing shortage suggests that the need for development of processes that take such challenges into consideration. So in view of increasing energy and water shortages in South Africa, of course, that we are all aware of, is there a future for hydrometallurgy in South Africa?
Oh, I think very much so. I mean, it actually, water and energy are equally important inputs into the classic pyrometallurgy and in many industrial processes. And what one needs to consider in particular is that hydrometallurgy in particular offers good opportunities for alternative or renewable energy sources. One example that we've been looking at is, for example, electrowinning, which is a classic hydrometallurgy process, draws a low voltage DC current, which is exactly what solar panels generate. And so there are opportunities to actually, rather than converting the energy into different forms, you can actually harness renewable energy sources, of which we've got plenty here in South Africa, particularly well in hydrometallurgical processes, because of, the most energy intensive step being actually very much aligned to what the solar resource gives you through photovoltaics. In terms of water, hydrometallurgy obviously by definition is an aqueous-based process, but water is not actually consumed that much because most hydrometallurgical processes are actually closed loop. You have, of course, a bit of a bleach stream that needs water treatment, but that's almost part of your process design right from the outset. So the water can even that after purification or whatever be recycled. And because you operate at relatively low temperatures, there is limited evaporation. Of course, you still need water, but I would say in comparison to other processes, relatively little. An interesting side note is also that a lot of water treatment and purification processes are in actual fact hydrometallurgical processes. So if you want to remove dissolved ions through precipitation or through reverse osmosis or any other membrane processes, that all plays quite strongly into the field of hydrometallurgy. And people with a hydrometallurgy background have generally a fairly good understanding of these water purification processes at the same time.
Okay, well, thanks, Prof, that we have seen opportunities where there are possible challenges, and also then bring the message home to South Africa where you look at solar resources, for example. So the next one then is maybe it's also a bit of a follow-up. Hydrometallurgy is associated with the use of reagents for the recovery of the products of interest. In some cases, hazardous reagents are used. So what are the new developments in equipment and reagents on the hydro side?
Hazardous reagents, I think probably first and foremost in everyone's mind is cyanide that's used in the hydrometallurgical recovery of gold. Although a lot of people with the expertise in the field will probably tell you that's really not something you need to worry about. If the amount of industrial accidents involving the direct poisoning by cyanide is actually remarkably low in the international comparison to other chemical accidents that may occur in the handling. But nonetheless, cyanide does have a bad name, bad rap, and not quite sure whether people. Yeah. Also, one aspect is that it's biodegradable, and so it's an actual fact cyanide does occur naturally, so it's not as much of a poison as people like to make it out, and it probably is fueled by this whole sort of James Bond type myth of or spies taking cyanide pills to eliminate themselves. But nonetheless, there are technologies underway to look at the at removing or alternatives to cyanide, so to mine come thiosulfate as a reagent that has been explored and actually also applied in practice. It's working, but not as well as one would hope. There's sort of speciality cases, special cases where the mineralogy makes that actually quite favorable. I think it's a lot to do with the presence of copper in the ore, because copper interferes quite massively. And unfortunately, a lot of gold ores also have significant amounts of copper, and then that process isn't really so viable. There's the idea of using glycine, a amino acid. There's a lot of research that's come up, and actually, interestingly, it's come out of Australia officially, but it originated here in South Africa, the idea of using glycine as an alternative or as a supplement to cyanide. So you can't quite replace cyanide, but you can use much lower doses by supplementing it with that amino acid, which is a sort of food product, and it's completely harmless, and so you can reduce hazardousness. Now, for other hydrometallurgical processes, the toxicity that varies very much and depends on the commodity and what process is being used. You have the toxicity, for example, in the PGM industry, you're dealing here with chlorine gas as an oxidant, and strong hydrochloric acid. Obviously, any acids are chemically aggressive, and you don't want to come in physical contact. But ultimately, if they handled in the appropriate manner in the industrial process and safety protocols are adhered to, you're actually fine. And that really gets me to the point more of, while alternatives continue to be explored, it's actually, my view, more important to actually ensure the process that you have are handled with the utmost care adherence to safety protocols, and then you are actually fine. It's mostly when you deal with it in a sort of haphazard manner where the problems occur. So an interesting case study that I've been involved in is actually the coming back to gold and cyanide, is the artisanal mining. Well, actually not cyanide, where you have where people still use mercury amalgamation in order to extract the gold from ore that they pan at the small scale. There's quite a lot of effort underway to kind of convince that industry, and it is an industry, to move away from mercury towards using cyanide. Whereas that's, of course, you kind of might think that's replacing one toxin with another, but the handling of cyanide actually is much easier and much less hazardous than the inhalation of mercury fumes. But then, of course, the idea is to go one step further and say, well, maybe they use that combination of cyanide combined with glycine, and gradually try and move that industry towards a more environmentally responsible handling of their chemicals. The magic potion is missing, but one can continuously searching. There was a long movement for biohydrometallurgy to kind of suddenly saying, okay, now that will replace us. We don't have to deal with toxic chemicals anymore. We just let bugs do the job. But I think there was a lot of hype around this, and the field's settled down quite a lot. Because, for example, bioleaching still takes place in a strongly acidic environment, and it still may release toxic chemicals such as arsenic into aqueous environment. So the fact that you're now doing it biologically does not necessarily make it green. And I think one needs to really then just look at the whole process. So if the leach step releases certain toxics, how do we take care of them? How do we recover them before they go out there and start to do harm in the environment. So it is really an interplay between looking for new reagents, yes, but also how processes are designed to minimize any harmful impact. And that particularly relates to the tail end of it, the waste treatment, the effluent treatment. If there is any, obviously one should try and avoid wastes. One should try and avoid effluents, but any engineer with a salt will say you will always have some waste product. It's not prescribed by thermodynamics, but if the process is designed as a whole, as a package, so to say, then new or greener chemicals will still need to be set up such that the process will make sure that there is no impact or through byproducts or unforeseen consequences that you can never predict.
Thanks for that comprehensive answer, Prof. So the next one is talking to the circular economy. I think you have touched on it a bit. So circular economy concepts are widely discussed in different industries. Could you paint a picture of circularity in hydrometallurgy?
Well, hydrometallurgy is not in that sense an industry, it's a technology. And I firmly believe that hydrometallurgy has got a big role to play, in particularly in the circular economy, in terms of returning products back into the cycle. So particularly metal recovery from post-consumer wastes, the famous one that everyone's looking at it. Well, the one is e-waste. And the other one is batteries, to say, well, they contain all sorts of valuable metals and very high concentrations, and we want to return those into raw materials for further processing, and then applying the waste hierarchy. Obviously, first price is to reuse and refurbish and then recycle. But in many cases, particularly with metal products, And rapidly advancing technologies, you know, today's the batteries you put into your radio today will be no longer useful in 10 years' time, and so we have to continuously adapt. And hydrometallurgical processes are definitely going to play a big role in the processing of or reprocessing of these materials. So it's not just hydrometallurgy in the context of producing primary resources, but possibly certain primary resources, produce them in a cleaner way than established processes, but also in the recovery of metals from post-consumer goods. One other aspect that I wanted to mention there is the scalability of hydrometallurgical processes. So you can run hydrometallurgical processes at small scale. Obviously there is always an economy of scale involved, but it's not as dramatic as in pyrometallurgical scale. So you can run hydrometallurgical processes with a few buckets and a pump. Whereas, you'll be hard stretched to do that with a pyrometallurgical process at the same scale with any degree of efficiency. That in the recycling field, that is a big bonus, because you can collect waste materials at a local scale, say in the city of Joburg or Cape Town. If you want to bring them to a central facility, then you would just not generate the tonnages that you would need for cost efficient recycling, which is a bit of a problem, because at the moment in South Africa there is any of this kind of recyclable electronic waste, and I believe battery waste as well, they are exported overseas to be processed in smelters, and it would make much more sense to do this locally. But we have not the economy of scale to make a smelter worthwhile. So, but hydrometallurgical processes can potentially fit that in at a sort of municipal scale for waste reprocessing. I believe that will apply for many, many different metallurgical products or metals that are in the system. And so, I think that's the role where hydrometallurgy will play an increasing role. And just harking back for a moment also to what we discussed earlier about education, it's now interesting when people talk about circular economy and processes for the circular economy. You get people who come out of manufacturing or general tech, sort of the tail end of materials processing, and they have fundamentally no understanding of the primary production processes. So that I'm sometimes astounded how little people know how metals are produced in the first place. But now all they're talking big about recycling and whatever. So I really think hydrometallurgy, as it is already practiced in the primary metal production, has a lot to teach to the recycling industry, who are at this point not populated by people with a primary metal production background. And I think there's a good future there, not just for the discipline, but also for young graduates. And one sees that in the research now in hydrometallurgy, a lot of it is revolving around how to recover metals from waste materials rather than from primary production.
The next one will be very specific. It will talk to critical metals. So, as we know, the world's dependency on metals has become more evident with the growing demand for metals required to drive advancements in the technological and digital landscape, and the energy transition, of course, for a carbon neutral future. Critical metals are in the center of this growing demand. So how significant is the role of hydrometallurgy in the extraction of critical metals?
Well, it depends very much on the individual metal. I think the production of critical metals, they're just different ones, and one sometimes has to develop new technologies. Sometimes those technologies are still the conventional pyrometallurgy or combinations of pyrometallurgy and hydrometallurgy or direct hydrometallurgy. And I think it's now just instead of the conventional, base metals, copper, nickel, zinc, for example. Now we're looking more interested in cobalt or lithium or rare earths. PGMs have always been basically a combination of pyro and hydrometallurgy. Rare earths, and it depends, for example, let's just use the example of rare earths, because that depends very much what form they come in, because you have rare earths that come in as minerals that you need to first concentrate up, and then you need fairly aggressive conditions, acid baking or alkali pressure leaching, in order to dissolve them, dissolve rare earth from the particularly from the monazite type minerals. But whereas you have the famous iron adsorption clays, which are basically secondary products for geological processes, where you just, they dissolve almost in water. Well, you have to have a bit of a lixiviant, but like salt or ammonium sulfate does a particularly good job. So they, upon contact with an aqueous solution, the rare earth instantly dissolve. And so, so it depends very much on the commodity, but also on the source. Where do these particular materials come from? The same go whether they're primary resources. So that's where geology plays a role. And I mentioned this much earlier. That I said it's a good thing for hydrometallurgists who deal with primary resources to have an understanding of mineralogy, because any mineral, a copper mineral is not just copper. There's different minerals, and they have to be treated in quite different ways, different technologies. Sometimes If the material is very refractory, you still have to use pyrometallurgy as much as you feel like it's energy intensive or whatever. And you would want to use hydromet, but then the conditions to do it in hydromet would have to be so aggressive that you're now dealing with very hazardous chemicals and it's not necessarily worth the switch. So you have, there's a lot of trading off that you have to do. And that's also what in modern days we end up doing is often comparing technologies against each other, not just in terms of what makes you the most money or what is best known, but also what has the most overall impact in terms of energy demand and environmental burden and including water consumptions, what you mentioned earlier. So it's the hydrometallurgy in the recovery of critical metals, that is really just along the lines of hydrometallurgy in the recovery of any metals, just that the focus, of course, now is those critical metals. We need to get them in the most efficient way, and we need to certain technologies. It's they are better on the hydromet side, but we must be careful not to just punt hydrometallurgy for the hydrometallurgy's sake, but always try and look at what is overall the most efficient and least impactful technology to recover these metals.
Okay, thanks, Prof. You touched a bit on the technical, now the technicalities of hydrometallurgical processing. So the next one is, with the advancements in the field of artificial intelligence, what are the opportunities that you can identify for hydrometallurgical processes?
I don't know. Maybe a bit of a Luddite. I think use your real intelligence first before you rely on artificial intelligence. I think one needs to really understand. It's become a bit of a buzzword and sort of means all things to all people. I feel where it has definitely a big role to play is in the area of process control. Because hydrometallurgical processes are often complex and not easy to sort of measure or determine what's going on. If you want to know, you know, how much, some things you can measure easily, like pH or solution potential, but concentrations of metals in solution, you will actually have to take and put into a laboratory and analyze. And so there's a serious time delay. So in process control, and I've seen some, but relatively limited efforts where people now trying to develop online sensors and then that will provide a much bigger flow of data in hydrometallurgical processes. And then you gotta obviously have now the software or the computing power to deal with this data and analyze it in a way how you can make the process run more efficiently. I mean, it's direct process control, but it is also sometimes more relating to general process operations management and so on can really benefit from this data analysis, and that would fall under the sort of big umbrella of artificial intelligence, because there's certain automation tools that you can apply in that context that process that data and analyze it and draw conclusions for it for you. In terms of developing new ideas, I'm very much saying don't put up false hope, because even today, artificial intelligence is only as intelligent as what we know. You know, this is the same as a computer, and I have some expertise in computer programming. You know, the old adage of garbage in, garbage out, or a computer model can only ever be as good as what the programmer knows and the knowledge that we have. We can't learn new things from a computer. We can just understand things better using a computer. And I think that's where one needs to kind of say we still need to
nurture research and development in academia or research organizations or within companies even, and not kind of feel like, oh, we just hand it all over to some computer and they will solve all our problems. So I think that while there's a role to play and it definitely has got a lot of potential to be developed, it needs to be developed with the right spirit that it can be a tool to operate your processes better and more efficiently, but not a tool to replace the human intelligence that needs to go into develop, particularly under the area of process development and novelty and innovation.
So one of the maybe the last technical question then from my side, you did touch a bit on this on modeling, but of course the previous one was really talking on artificial intelligence. How important is modeling in hydrometallurgy?
Very, precisely because those processes are complex. They're not that easy to understand. You can't sort of forge them into a simple two-parameter equation. Unfortunately, even in academia, that's what a lot of people end up doing. I always like to cite sort of the famous, because we all learned that in undergrad studies, the shrinking core model, right? So people do some leach test and then they fit the shrinking core model to it. I had been, I actually didn't mention that in the beginning, I've been the editor of the journal Hydrometallurgy for many years. And I was always shocked in a way to what extent people use sort of like a simple, relatively simple model very uncritically, because they don't really understand the limitations of the model and whether or not it's actually applicable in the present context. Because if you look down, if you zoom in, just sticking with leaching at the surface of a mineral particle or even a waste particle, there's a complex, an incredibly complex system of processes that are taking place. Excuse me, that aid in the dissolution of the metals, and the understanding of that needs to be there, not just in terms of I understand this is going on, but to represent that through much more comprehensive models and models. One needs to also appreciate and make a distinction here between physical models that make a physical description of the process, that is in some ways always a bit of a simplification, but a sensible simplification, and what you then stick into a computer. So computer models, again, are really just a numerical representation of those physical models that is in someone's understanding. And I think for process modeling as a chemical engineer, we all know that to do meaningful process modeling, process understanding, you always need to model it. You need to get your mass balances right, your energy balances. So the same goes for hydrometallurgical processing. You really modeling is a core tool in our discipline, in the toolbox. But it's quite often sort of not appreciated enough for what it is. So here I'm talking really with my process engineer's hat on, where the modeling is critical, but it's also an established discipline. But it's perhaps if you come into hydrometallurgy as a metallurgist or as a chemist, then that is not what you're so well trained in, but there needs to then be understanding that modeling is a critical role. But let me emphasize again that modeling is just a tool, is a support to understand things better so that you can improve on your existing process, but not something that will ever replace the application of the fundamental knowledge in developing these processes.
I fully agree with you, Prof. Many thanks. So we are almost at the end of this podcast, but I would like to touch a bit on entrepreneurship and innovation. How amenable is South Africa to implementing new processes in hydrometallurgy? And how does South Africa compare globally in this regard?
That's an interesting question. So now, as an academic, I'm not necessarily in direct touch, but I have come across, actually, particularly in recent times, from quite a few people with some long-term industrial experience who now go ventured out and become sort of an entrepreneur. They have their small firms. Sometimes they do it by themselves or with a few people to work with them to develop new processes, to service other necessarily not just the extractive industry, but in hydrometallurgy, there's a lot of people work in the sort of wastewater treatment field. And I've seen definitely a lot of innovation. To what extent that innovation comes to fruition is, of course, very much not just dependent on the specific technology and how successful it is, but also a lot of on how it's marketed, how people manage, what connections people manage to build in order to interest investors in their technology. And it is the famous gap that that somewhere exists between the in principle demonstration of your technology and in a laboratory or conceptual scale, and then making it real, building a pilot plant, because that is generally a costly intervention, and it's like where people are least interested. I remember, for example, talking once to the CEO of a big mining company who was basically saying, we're not interested in developing technology, we buy technology, you know? And I thought that's just a very stupid thing to say, because who's going to then develop the technology? Because there is a serious investment, financial investment that has to be made to develop technology to the point where it becomes marketable. And that's also where often people just don't want to step in. Private finance, there are things here in South Africa. There is TIER, organizations that specifically focus on helping people develop technologies bring them to the market, from idea to the market. But it is the hard part, the hard slog, and the entrepreneurs need to invest a lot of their personal energy and time for an uncertain outcome, because many new technologies fail not because they're maybe just not good technologies, or the people may be good technically, but they're not the right kind of marketing people. And I think there is a certain risk averseness, particularly among a younger generation, that I've definitely noticed, who would probably be reluctant to go out and become entrepreneurs. And it's generally more people with a lot of experience and connections under their belt, people in their 40s or 50s who are the ones who then venture out and become entrepreneurs. How that compares internationally, it's a bit hard to say. I mentioned earlier in Australia, hydrometallurgy is actually sort of almost disappearing out of academia, but there's a lot of thriving industry of people, of small companies promoting or selling technology, and drive a lot of innovation in the process. But then you also have a thriving mining industry, which makes an effort to entertain new ideas and gives people the opportunities to try out technologies better than I have the impression happens here. And so, like, bearing in mind that CEO that I mentioned earlier, I think in South Africa, it's an industry that is sort of somewhat averse to innovation, as much as there is limited government support, although there's a good intention to drive that drive government support, but it's not nearly enough, and so that's why I still feel in South Africa it's a little sporadic, could be a lot stronger, but I think the talent is there, the knowledge is there historically, And it really just needs to be built upon. And there needs to be more consensus between, you know, academia, industry, and government to nurture that kind of talent and bring out more entrepreneurship into the field, particularly for small scale operators. And what I said earlier about, particularly in the area of waste, reprocessing, recovery of metals from waste, there are great opportunities there for entrepreneurs to enter the field at a relatively small scale. And that's perhaps also important to bear in mind that hydrometallurgy, as it is practiced in South Africa, in the mining industry, often huge processes, you know, like where you could never become a platinum refinery, as a startup, you know, that's not possible. It's not going to happen, but you could, by recovering just say PGMs from waste material or like auto catalysts, for example, that you can do, in your garage and you get entrepreneurs who actually, as I said earlier, put together some buckets and get some chemicals and operators. And as long as they do it in a safe and environmentally sound manner, then that is the kind of people which gives an opportunity for an entrepreneur to enter the market and then develop industries from there. So that's my vision. I believe there's the opportunities there, but it needs to it needs a concerted support from all spheres of that in order to nurture this.
Prof, you have added, we started off with entrepreneurship and innovation, and it looks like we went to ESG as well, and you added G and the S. With, of course, the E, we have been talking a lot to that, to the environmental aspects, but it looks like now you have talked a bit to the S and to the G. Maybe can you expand a bit there? Because, of course, I mean, ESG is becoming more important. It's a buzzword. And how has ESG impacted developments in hydrometallurgy? And maybe what are the forthcoming attractions driven by ESG?
That's an interesting aspect, particularly, I want to talk about the S a little bit. And that's something that where my eyes opened a lot because I've done work on, artisanal mining. I mentioned this earlier in gold mining. And, I'm also part of a community of practice that's looking at, value recovery from waste materials. And in both projects now you're dealing with sort of like what one would term the lowest of the lowest of society, you know, with waste pickers, people who climb over waste dumps and pick up whatever they can sell and or go from door to door to collect, try and collect some old disused broken equipment and artisanal miners who's, you know, little groups of people who scratch around and pan some gold from small resources. Here in South Africa, we term them, illegal miners, but in particular, we've done a lot of work with those groups in Zimbabwe and where they are actually a major part of the gold mining community. And they're actually supported by the government. Well, supported, let's say they're, but the government, works with them. From that point of view, comparing these two sectors, they're quite different. There's actually a lot of similarities, and you start to realize it's a livelihood for people. And sometimes in this modern day and age, we forget that industrial activity ultimately it's there to create jobs, to provide people with livelihoods. And there's no reason why technology needs to be excluded from people like that. And to make sure that they would do whatever they do, they can earn a livelihood, but do so in a safe and environmentally sound manner. And so these things, but that in order to establish that, that's where the G comes in, the governance. You know, how do you make sure there's fair play happening? And I think that is something that I feel like, particularly in South Africa, but it's really completely out of my hand, is where we discover again and again, we have good laws and we have lousy enforcement of these laws. So the regulations are there, and they're often sensible. And if they're not sensible, then they can actually be amended, because there's people, there's a lot of sort of activity, particularly sort of in terms of the formulation of our environmental laws. There's strong environmental lobbies and activism that's going on that is making sure that processes are dealt with properly, that legacies are addressed, and so on. But the enforcement thereof is quite a different story. And I feel like particularly the environmental, the cleanup that results from gold mining, from all historic mining, where you have these old tailings dams in Joburg that are being basically refurbished and reclaimed, and some gold being extracted from it, so in a profitable manner, that is actually where all of these come together. And if you can do it in a way that not just enriches a few, but actually does it so in a sort of equitable manner, then I think that is pretty much what we should be aiming for. And I think the waste recovery field offers plenty of opportunities for that, perhaps more so than the primary recovery. One needs to ensure with this, I mean, you have some backyard recycler, probably you have seen somewhere where somebody, you know, a guy comes to the door, asks for a broken piece of equipment and goes into the bush and smashes it up and leaves half of it lying around in order to sell what's valuable. Or you have seen the burning TV by the side of the road. That stuff needs to go. That needs to be brought under control. But for someone to go and earn a bit of money from recycling, that should definitely be encouraged.
Many thanks, Prof. So just a quick recap. We started off with the education questions related to hydrometallurgy. And I think what stood out for me there was the importance of collaborations and the network as well. And then we went to the technicalities of hydrometallurgy, and I think the big question was the first one, as to whether there's a future of hydrometallurgy. And from the technical discussion we've had there, the message is very clear that there is the future for hydrometallurgy is bright. And we went to entrepreneurship and innovation, which is, of course, quite important also for the South African context. And lastly, we ended with ESG. And what I like and what also stands out for me under ESG is the inclusion, that this also can be inclusive. And, of course, there was a lot that we discussed throughout the conversation, that throughout the podcast, that talked to the environmental aspects, that talked to a set economy concepts. So, Prof, before we wrap up, I started off by introducing the Hydrometallurgy Conference 2024, which is scheduled to take place in September this year in Stellenbosch. And as the chair of this conference, or co-chair of this conference, could you kindly take us through some of the forthcoming attractions that will be covered in the conference?
Yes, of course. So the conference has actually had a remarkably strong response, with people submitting papers, mostly local, but quite a few contributions from overseas, from academia, from industry. So we have a fantastic blend. And it's also interesting to see that the topics covered basically straddle very much primary extraction and primary production of metals from primary resources, and recycling processes and looking at novel chemistries for both primary production and for recycle type processes. So that is very much blended together. And in setting up the program, we struggled a little bit to say, should we make the focus on recycling, or make a focus on primary extraction? And in the end, we actually went down to making the focus probably mostly on, well, A, commodities, and B, technologies where there is enough contribution. So if I want to just give an example on solvent extraction and ion exchange, there's many contributions, but the context in which they're applied can be both from primary production and secondary production, recovery of critical metals and of base metals, sort of the classic hydrometallurgy. But the response to us told, I mean, the conference runs over 2 days and we're looking forward to present, having some 60 papers that will be presented and some keynotes and we're still finalizing the keynote speakers, but we hope to again have a blend for people who talk to technology, particularly in the recycling sector, which is strong in Europe. And we have a speaker, Professor Koen Binnemans from Belgium, who is a well-known figure in the area of recycling technology or hydrometallurgy for recycling. And then for extraction from primary commodities, such as, this has not been confirmed yet, but Professor Lilian Velasquez from Chile, she will talk specifically about the extraction of copper from primary resources, which is obviously a big market in Chile. So from that point of view, there's a little bit for everyone at this conference. And so we're hoping to have fruitful discussions, participation from industry, from students, from academics, and basically illustrating, as you said, the future for hydrometallurgy is bright.
Prof, you could not have rounded off in a better way. So yes, I think you've rounded the entire talk in a nice way. Yes, the future of hydrometallurgy is bright. I'm at ease hearing that. And many thanks for joining us, Prof, and looking forward to the Hydrometallurgy Conference 2024. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please note that the facts and opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not reflect the position of SIAEM or the corporate institution.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.